This is Mac Format This Week. 30 minutes of news, reviews, Q&A, and features from the world of the Macintosh, iPod, and iPhone. Coming up on this edition, iPhone frenzy hits British shores.
I do love my iPhone. It's as good as you thought it was going to be when you saw the demos and when you read about it. It's even better in your hand.
Author Bob Levitis joins us with 4 months of iPhone experience to tell you the good and the bad of Apple's first mobile phone. Also coming up, whose iPhone is it anyway?
When I buy a product, I should be able to do with it what I want. I shouldn't be restricted to what Apple allows.
We'll debate the pros and cons of you deciding what goes on your iPhone. Details of upgraded Mac laptops and our regular Q&A, all in this edition of Mac Format This Week. With the resources of Mac Format Magazine, this is Mac Format This Week. Hi, everyone, and thanks again for joining us. I'm Brad Gibson. Well, the wait is over. After 134 days, iPhone fever has hit British shores. The revolutionary phone, that has already been heralded by one British technology magazine as the coolest gadget of the year, went on sale November 9th. The 8GB iPhone will retail for £269, including VAT. Its pricing packages will start at £35 for 200 inclusive minutes and unlimited data and Wi-Fi. That goes up to £55 for 1,200 minutes and unlimited data and Wi-Fi access via the cloud network. Those selling it are Apple's retail store, including their online store, O2, its exclusive mobile network partner, and Carphone Warehouse, the only independent store allowed to offer the iPhone. But with all the buzz in the UK about Apple's handheld marvel that has already sold over 2 million since its debut June 29th in America, one survey showed just 1% of Britons polled would be buying an iPhone after they found out how much it would cost and the hefty monthly contract plan that went along with it. But even so, the iPhone is getting a lot of interest, and Apple stores on November 9th and over the weekend were packed. So what should you know about the iPhone before laying out big bucks? Is it as great as everyone says? Well, one guy who should know is Bob Levitis. As a well-known Mac columnist and writer, Levitis is the co-author of the just-released book iPhone for Dummies, published by Wiley Publishing. He's been playing around with the iPhone for 4 months and 12 days, to be exact. He joins us now from Austin, Texas, to share with us his impressions of what it's like to be a true iPhone user. Thanks for joining us, Bob.
It's 4 months, 12 days, and 22 hours and 15 minutes, actually.
Oh, you're exactly counting down to the second. That's how much you love this phone.
I do love my iPhone, and you guys are in for a treat. You really are. It's as good as you thought it was going to be when you saw the demos and when you read about it. It's even better in your hand. I'm still, even after 4 months, I'm still totally tickled with it. I mean, we'll talk about flaws later, but overall, it's by far the best phone I've ever had, by far.
So as we said at the start, you've had a chance to use and play with it for a little over 4 months, and I think your insight into its daily use would be really interesting for our listeners and readers. So let me just start by asking you this. If I came to your home right now and took your iPhone away from you, would I have to pry it away, as they say, from your cold, dead fingers?
You sure would. You absolutely would. Yeah, it's like a part of me now. It's an appendage. I don't carry my MacBook Pro around with me very much, you know, but I'm never far from my phone. In fact, I've had my office phone forwarded to the iPhone pretty much for 4 months.
Right.
Just because I like using it so much.
So what's the one feature that you just can't do without?
That's a tough one because there's a bunch of great features, and I'll try to talk about all of them. I think in the big scheme of things is having really usable web browser with me wherever I go. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just the coolest thing in the world to be able to, find a Chinese restaurant in my neighborhood or use the Maps application to see if there's traffic on the highway before I set out from my house. I get down to the light at the corner, and it's I wonder if there's traffic on the highway. I can just pull my phone going out, tap once. Oh, look, it's all crowded. I'll have to go a different way.
Right, right.
It's awesome. You know, people complain about the speed of the edge network, but for most stuff, it's not too bad. I don't generally curse it too much every once in a while.
Well, so how much are you using it on the edge network versus Wi-Fi in like Starbucks or at home or other places where your speed is probably a lot better?
It is a lot better, but I'd say I use it probably 30 to 40% on edge. Yeah, you don't want to be doing heavy web surfing on graphics-laden pages over edge if you can help it. Mm-hmm. But for finding the occasional page and certainly for Googling something and, you know, getting to a web page and seeing the information you need, it's fine. It's really not too bad. And in fact, the other applications, maps and weather and stuff and stocks, update pretty fast over Edge.
Right.
I think that it sounded worse than it is. At least my experience has been. Now, people tell me in some cities it's worse than it is here.
Right.
You know, your mileage may vary.
Okay, so setting aside the Wi-Fi network and internet access and the browser, some of the other great things that you like about the phone.
I like visual voicemail. I like the idea that my voicemails come in and I can look at the phone numbers, you know, from caller ID. If they're in my phone book, I can see their names. Listen to them in any order I want. Not listen to them if I choose. I don't have to listen to them sequentially, which I really like because most people leave long messages. It's nice to be able to pick and choose who you're going to listen to now and who you're going to, like, maybe listen to later. I really like the video. I don't watch that much long-form video. I mean, I guess on an airplane. I haven't taken that many trips since I've had my phone, but on a plane, I would stock it up with some video and watch on an airplane. That would be fine. But what I find it great for is my son's a high school football player, mm-hmm. and I shoot his games and then come back and edit it in iMovie and dump them onto the phone. And then wherever I am, some people reach into their pocket and show you pictures in their wallet. I reach into my pocket and show you video on my phone. And that screen is the most gorgeous screen you've ever seen on a handheld device. It's unbelievably beautiful.
I asked you a few minutes ago what's so great about the iPhone. So let me now ask you, what's wrong with the iPhone?
First and foremost, it's got Bluetooth, and it works with just about any Bluetooth headset, including the Apple one. But it doesn't do voice dialing, which to me is just really surprising. I've had phones now for years that could voice dial through the headset, which I love. You know, I'm in the car. I like to say, call Lisa, call Allison, rather than having to fumble with the phone and click on their name to dial their number or, you know, whatever. Anything that takes my eyes off the road is bad. Another one is, you know, what's the deal with ringtones? Why do I have to buy my ringtones from the Apple iTunes store for 99 cents, especially if I've already paid for the song? It just seems wrong to me, and all my other phones let me make song snippets and send them to the phone over either Bluetooth or SMS and use them as ringtones.
Right.
Let me put in a plug for the nice folks at Ambrosia, who have come out with a terrific little $15 app called iToner, and it lets you put your own ringtones on. So I edit them up in GarageBand and, you know, fade them in and out and cut them to the right length and export them, and I've got lots of ringtones. Everybody has a personalized ringtone that suits their personality or place in my life.
You know, the thing that I've not had a chance to really play around with the iPhone as much as you have, but I wish it had more PDA features, you know, creating to-do lists and letting users sync to notes and other things like that. Do you miss some of those PDA-like features that you think the phone should have?
Not really, because for one thing, I mostly want it the way it is, which is that it syncs with my stuff at my Mac and lets me have the alarms from iCal while I'm away.
Mm-hmm.
That's way more important to me than the ability to create an appointment while I'm out and about on the phone. I'd like to have the syncing of notes, but there are a couple of workarounds for that. There's a couple of nice web apps that you could use for to-do lists or notes. And then there's also the trick with contacts, you know, address book. You can just create a bogus contact and use one of the notes field. I think it's 32 or 128K. It's enough text for most people most of the time.
Any other things, Bob, that you wish that you want to see in the next version of the phone or you wish you had now?
Well, I'll tell you what really ticked me off until I bought about four of those little dongles. The fact that you can't use your third-party earphones without the little adapter.
Right.
The way the case is designed, you can't just stick a third-party headphone jack in it. Almost all of them are a little too fat. And so you either have to buy these little, Radtech sells one for like $6, $7. They're just little extensions with thinner jacks on the end. They just make it so that it'll fit into your iPhone.
Uh-huh.
And I've got one at the house and one in the car and one in my backpack. I don't go anywhere without one, but it's pretty annoying that I have to.
Many smartphones let you access the internet, but very few have succeeded at doing it very well, and none have come really close enough to approximating the experience that you get on a computer. So what I want to ask you is, does the iPhone come closest or not?
Oh, absolutely. I was not a smartphone person before. I've tried BlackBerries and I've tried Trios, and they just didn't cut it for me. And for me now, having Safari, mobile Safari on the phone, I do use it all the time, and it is easy to use, and it is gratifying. It's, as Steve said, it's the real internet. You know, it's not this dumbed-down mobile internet, special pages formatted for your phone with really dorky-looking text.
Bob, with only 8 gigabytes of storage in flash on this phone, are you finding yourself having to juggle a lot of music versus video on your iPhone?
Well, no, because I have a Classic. I have an iPod Classic with 160 gigabytes, and it's got everything. And so it's not that big a deal for me. When I'm out running around, I've got a nice subset of both video and audio and pictures. And I don't really find myself messing with it too much. It's set to, when I buy new stuff, it automatically transfers it. It basically, one of my playlists is everything I bought in the last 6 months. But it hasn't been as bad as I thought it would be. You know, I've never had a small iPod. I've always had the biggest iPod you can get. My media library is 70 gigabytes, you know, video and audio. So, you know, I've always had everything I wanted with me wherever I went.
Right.
I thought that this would be uncomfortable, but it's not. How much music can I listen to in a week?
Let's have you talk to those out there that have either bought an iPhone already or are so committed to getting one that there's no stopping them now. They're going to get one any day now. Give me and them two or three top iPhone tips from your book that they can easily use.
Okay, the first one, when I figured out that you could do this, it was like a real eye-opener. The way the punctuation works, there's a separate screen when you're typing for punctuation, and the natural way to use it would be to punch the button to change to punctuation, tap the punctuation you want, then tap the button again to go back to a keyboard.
Right.
That's like three steps to type a period or an exclamation point or an at sign. And so if you don't lift your finger up, in other words, if you tap on the little button that switches you to punctuation but don't lift your finger up, It switches to the punctuation screen. Move your finger over to the punctuation you want, and it will insert it and then let go, and it pops you back to the typing keyboard.
Oh, I got it. That's very cool.
So in other words, it saves you two taps each time, and that's something, you know, you do probably at the end of every sentence. Now, there's a new shortcut after the 1.1.1 update that if you double tap the space bar, it'll give you a period and a space, which is great because that's the most common punctuation. That's even faster.
Give us some other tips.
Well, there's a tip in the book about how to use, Google's got a proxy server that's designed for mobile devices, and it feeds you the mobile versions of many pages, and it's much, much faster. It's not pretty, but if you're trying to get the most text through your browser and onto the screen as quickly as possible, especially over Edge, that little tip on how to do that is awesome. There's also a good troubleshooting chapter, a lot of stuff about, you know, what to do so that you don't have to go and search Apple's website for half an hour to find all this stuff.
Right.
Basically, it's all condensed down to maybe 10 pages. And then it says, if you didn't find the answer here, here are the URLs for the things you want at Apple.
One final question for you. If you had any recommendations or advice for Brits who are about to consider buying an iPhone, what would they be?
I wish I knew when the third generation stuff was coming, because if I thought that it was going to come soon, I'd say, well, wait, because you'll really be miserable if you buy this now and in 2 or 3 months there's a third generation handset. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's going to be a while, you know, like mid-2008 or something, maybe even later. I can't think of a reason not to get it if you can afford it. What's really interesting is I expected to see my phone bill go up a little, even with the new data plan that we had to buy. My bill is actually a little bit less now.
Right.
For me, at least, with AT&T in America, it hasn't been more expensive than my old phone, and it's certainly way more functional.
Bob, thanks so much for talking to us about the iPhone. I think people have gotten a really good idea of what they can expect when they get this phone and what they need to look for if they're going to buy it.
I did want to say one more thing. The truth is, when I was writing the book, Apple lent me an iPhone. I got it right the day that they came out, or maybe the day before they came out. I kept it for, I think, 45 days. And then they asked for it back. And I was almost done with the book, and I really didn't need to go buy one, and I wasn't planning to go buy one. But when Apple asked for theirs back, I went that very day and plunked down $600. I couldn't stand being without it. And that, I think, says something about it. It was so satisfying and so just such a great thing that when they took it away, I couldn't stand it, and I went out and bought one, I think, 4 hours after I packed theirs up and sent it back. I couldn't take it anymore.
I think that says volumes about the phone from someone who really has a lot of experience in computers and that kind of thing. To say that, is, I think, really means a lot. Bob, thanks so much for the time. Really appreciate it. I think you've given people some really good ideas and thoughts that they should think about before they buy an iPhone.
Well, I think those of you that are going to get one, I think you're going to enjoy it a lot. And don't forget iPhone for Dummies.
We sure won't. Bob, thanks so much for the time.
My pleasure.
Bob Levitis is co-author of the just-released book iPhone for Dummies, published by Wiley Publishing. He joined us from Austin, Texas. As a special deal, and for the first time on the Mac Format This Week podcast, you can read two chapters from Bob's new book by going to your saved podcast directory in iTunes and clicking on the two attached PDF files that you'll see right below the listing of the Mac Format This Week podcast for November 12th. Simply double-click on each of the two PDFs, and they'll open in either Preview or Adobe's Acrobat Reader. As those of us in Europe have been waiting to get our hands on an iPhone, American users have been part of an ongoing tit-for-tat soap opera over the right to not only put whatever applications they'd like on an iPhone, but the right to use it with any mobile phone carrier, not just AT&T Wireless. On one side are Apple and AT&T Wireless, which say they have the right to restrict the iPhone's access to other networks on the grounds that it would impact profits. They also want to restrict users from using the iPhone like a Macintosh PC and putting whatever applications on it they'd like. The reason for that, they say, is their concern that the iPhone could end up being a hotbed of mobile phone viruses, and that could impact future sales. On the other side, a ragtag group of developers who feel that a customer's right to put whatever they want on their iPhone and use it with whatever carrier they want is their God-given right. Over the past 4 months, these developers have released unlockers for the iPhone to use it on other mobile phone networks, only to have Apple seal up those holes. iPhone owners who took the chance at installing those patches have ended up on the receiving end of various problems, including no support from Apple to return their phone to normal working order with AT&T Wireless. But while Apple and AT&T Wireless might have a point in restricting what network their iPhone works on, do they really have a right to tell you what you can put on it? Nicholas Penray is Chief Technology Officer for Conceited Software and a member of the iPhone and iPod Touch development teams. I recently spoke to him from Albany, New York, and began by asking him to explain the goals of the iPhone and iPod Touch development teams.
The ultimate goal for both development teams is to open up the iPhone and iPod Touch to third-party application development. The devices have such great potential that to keep them closed, it hinders the experience, I think. I think that Apple sees the issue that they had by not releasing an SDK, and they see the demand for it with all of our applications and, you know, AppSnap, AppTap, and all the other, you know, there's tens, 20s of different jailbreak utilities available now.
Are you breaking any American or European Union laws by creating a fix for the iPhone user to modify their firmware and install other applications?
To the best of my knowledge, we are not breaking any U.S. or European laws by basically enabling third-party applications. I know Germany just passed a law recently which, you know, it makes it illegal for anyone to have quote-unquote security breaching utilities on their systems. So, I mean, that's a possibility, but I'm not breaking any U.S. laws.
I'd like to concentrate on AppSnap primarily because if there's an area where iPhone owners probably have more of a right to control putting whatever software they want on their device, it's probably with AppSnap. What exactly does AppSnap do?
What AppSnap does is it uses the TIFF vulnerability in the current Safari web browser on the iPhone and iPod Touch to enable third-party applications by basically enabling write access to the root file system. What it also does is it installs Null River's installer.app program, which it makes it very easy to get all the third-party applications available. If your iPhone is not activated with AT&T, say you bought the iPhone prior to the iPod Touch just because you like the device so much, not because you want to use it as a phone, it will enable you to get to Springboard, which is the main application on the iPhone, to launch third-party applications. It also has a patch to Springboard, which enables paging, which is a new feature that Apple actually put out in 1.1.1. And once it enables all those features, it patches the vulnerability so that malicious websites can't break your phone afterwards.
So what you're basically doing is taking advantage of a security hole in the iPhone firmware to enable AppSnap to install third-party applications.
Correct.
And unlike your AnySIM software utility that unlocks phones to use with any network, AppSnap, you say, won't hurt your iPhone, right?
Right. If you decide you don't want it on your phone anymore, a simple restore in iTunes will wipe it right off and put your phone back to factory condition.
I would assume with the next update of the iPhone firmware, Apple will patch that security hole you're now taking advantage of, don't you think?
Yeah, I have it on good authority. I actually have some inside sources at Apple who have told me that the vulnerability has already been patched in the new firmware, which will be coming out.
You know, as crazy as it sounds, I would think that developers like yourself who find these holes and use them, and then Apple finds out about them and fixes them, actually, in a way, you're doing Apple a favor in many ways, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's been many contests, you know, where they have week-long bug hunting contests and they try to find vulnerabilities. They always report them to Apple and Apple fixes them. And that's pretty much what we're doing, except we're getting what we want while Apple gets what they want.
How sure are you that once they patch up the security hole that allows AppSnap to work, that you can work around it and other vulnerabilities to make AppSnap work again?
Where there's a will, there's a way. You can't make a system 100% secure no matter what anyone says. Hopefully we won't have to break in when they release the SDK in February. Hopefully it'll be exactly what we're looking for and meet our needs and everybody wins.
Let's talk about the ethics of AppSnap. I mean, right now, Apple doesn't want people to install third-party applications. Do you feel that by taking advantage of the security flaw in the iPhone that you're doing users a service or a disservice?
I mean, I would definitely say it's a service. You know, when I buy a product, I should be able to do with it what I want. I shouldn't have, you know, I shouldn't be restricted to what Apple allows. There are people smarter and who have more creative ability than Apple. I want to get those applications on my phone.
Apple has promised that they will come out with a software development kit, or what they call an SDK, for the iPhone next February that will let developers create applications. But there's a lot of pessimism, as you know, that this SDK will actually be a completely open development tool. Is your work a way of sending Apple a message that they should open up the platform to restriction-free development? Or exactly what is the message that you're trying to deliver to them?
That's exactly it. I mean, we want to be able to create applications that can do anything, just like on the Mac. That's what makes the Mac so great, is it's easy and elegant to create applications on a Mac, and the iPhone, it runs a version of OS X, so it should be really similar to the Mac. Mac developers want to be able to write, you know, applications for another Apple OS.
Let me play devil's advocate here. Apple is saying that by opening up the phone to any application and anything that anyone wants to install, that you're leaving a vulnerability to lots of viruses, and thereby that would hurt the phone itself, and obviously for them it would hurt sales. What do you say to that?
You know, there is a possibility that someone could create a malicious application. But, I mean, that risk exists today on all personal computers and any cell phone other than, I believe, the Sidekick. I think it's up to the user to decide whether he wants to take that risk or not.
So basically, buyer beware.
Exactly. You can disable applications by default, and if someone decides, I want to install applications, they can go through the process and install them themselves. It doesn't have to be an Apple-driven service.
You talk to developers on a regular basis, talk to them through message boards online, etc. Have you any indication at this point just how open, or should I say just how restrictive, this iPhone SDK will be?
It's really a mixed bag. I've talked to some people who say that the SDK will be open to anyone, and, you know, distribution will be through iTunes, much like podcasts, where, you know, anyone can submit podcasts and, you know, they're free, so you have that ability. But I've also heard where Apple will allow only Apple developer select members to get the SDK, and there won't be any freeware apps. You'll be able to purchase apps in iTunes, which Apple will then get a percentage of. So really, it's all speculation at this point.
From a consumer perspective, if Apple were to restrict developers from unfettered access to the phone, what would be the downside for iPhone users, in your opinion?
I mean, you're losing out on a lot of things that you, you know, right now there's a VNC client, which allows you to connect remotely to machines and control, you know, control them from anywhere. And I use that on a daily basis. And I think if I couldn't have that, that makes the phone worth less to me. And, you know, I might look at another option. If Apple does decide to do that, the iPhone dev team would definitely pursue unlocking the phone again.
Tell us a little bit about AppSnap. How long has it been out, and how many downloads have you had of it so far?
Okay, we released AppSnap on Monday, October 29th. So far, we've had about 190,000 downloads, which is roughly, I would say, about 130,000 installs.
You must feel good about this, that you're actually doing something that you guys feel from the people who have downloaded it and the interest that you've gotten, that you're providing a service that right now Apple's not.
Definitely. We do this for fun. We love to do this. Like I said, we're all Apple fans. We love Apple products. We love the iPhone. It's just great to see it actually open and, you know, build a community off of it.
Nicholas Penray is Chief Technology Officer for Conceited Software and a member of the iPhone and iPod Touch development teams. He joined us from Albany, New York. A postscript now. We offered Apple the opportunity to tell their side of the story regarding iPhone security, preventing the installation of applications, and its plans for the software development kit. They did not return our repeated phone calls. A quick update now on Apple's MacBook and MacBook Pro. On the 1st of November, Apple quietly upgraded its laptop line, what many call speed bumps. But besides a jump in Intel Core 2 Duo processor speeds, a few other significant changes occurred that will mean even faster responses and faster graphics. Mac Format Deputy Editor Chris Finn joins us from the newsroom to tell us about the changes. Chris, let's start with the MacBooks. The base 13-inch white model processor speed stays at 2.0 gigahertz, while the two other models got speed bumps.
That's right. The top two models now go up to 2.2 gigahertz. That's up from 2.16, so a fairly minimal change. The prices are bang on the same. It starts off $699 for the 2.0 gigahertz entry-level white model. The mid-range white model, the 2.2 gigahertz, is £829, and the very top-end model, the black, matte black MacBook, is now £949 as it was before.
So the great thing is faster speeds, but the prices didn't go up, so that's really good. Now, there's also been an architectural change in the Intel Core 2 Duo. Explain as simply as you can what has changed and its significance.
You'll remember that the MacBook Pros recently were upgraded to Intel's Santa Rosa platform, and the same has happened for the MacBooks now. They're now based on the Santa Rosa platform as well, up from the Calistoga chipset that they did used to use. What that means in broad terms is that we should see faster speeds, and we should see faster speeds partly because there's a faster bus speed, it's up to 800 megahertz, but we should also see a bit more battery life as well.
But Chris, there are several other changes that are really big news here.
You're quite right. The memory allocation now has gone up to a maximum of 4 gigabytes. Now, it was at 2 gigabytes, which is still fairly generous, but now it's gone up to 4, which matches the MacBook Pros. And that means that you can really use the MacBook as a pretty meaty mid-level machine for everything up to and including moderate video work and some moderate high-end design work as well. 4 gig of RAM is a decent amount of space. It means you can have lots and lots of applications open at once, which is particularly useful if you're working in something like Adobe's Creative Suite. As I've said before, the front side bus has gone up to 800 megahertz. That's up from 667 megahertz. And the front side bus is that bit of the computer that governs the speed at which information can be shunted around the various different components in the Mac. So having a fast front side bus is quite important. But the most important, the most exciting thing is the integrated graphics chip has finally been upgraded. Now, it's still integrated graphics, that is to say it's not a discrete graphics chip. It doesn't have its own CPU, or rather a GPU, a graphical processor unit. It's still tied into the main CPU, and it still hogs some of the RAM from your main RAM allocation. But the model's gone up from the GMA 950 to the X3100. We've never seen this in a Mac before. We don't know how well it's going to perform once we actually get it into the office and give it a test. But the reaction from the industry, particularly obviously on the PC side where they've had this chip before and it's been tested by our colleagues in different PC magazines, has been very, very positive indeed. It may even mean that the MacBook is now a credible low-end gaming platform, whereas it really wasn't before, which was always ironic because the MacBook was the perfect family machine and the one thing it can't do is play games, which is one thing that you'd want a family machine to be able to do. The introduction of the X3100 should mean that the MacBook is now a pretty decent little gaming machine.
Right. So we'll have to wait and see what kind of actual speed improvements we get when you and the team have a chance to actually put these new machines through their paces. Final question to you, Chris. Would you say this machine is not really the laptop that you want for Final Cut Pro, but definitely for Final Cut Express HD?
Well, it kind of depends on what kind of work you're trying to do. I mean, Final Cut Express and Final Cut even the Professional Edition aren't really that graphics card intensive, and they're not particularly processor intensive either, because all you're doing is you're scrubbing through video and you're putting in little place markers. The part where the power of the machine becomes important is when you're exporting and flattening and rendering out your files. Yes, it's a cracking machine for Final Cut Express, but you could actually run Final Cut Pro on it fairly simply, as long as you had a little bit more patience.
Chris, thanks so much for going over these changes to the MacBook and the MacBook Pro. We'll see you again.
My pleasure, Brad. Thank you.
Chris Finn is deputy editor of MacFormat magazine. Always trying to help our readers and listeners get the most out of their Apple products, Trevor Middleton joins us as usual with questions and answers. How are you, Trevor?
Very good, Brad. How are you?
Very good. On each show, Trevor answers your questions about anything to do with the Mac, iPod, or iPhone. And you can email us with your queries to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. And please remember to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. Question one is from Matthew Spiegel of San Rafael, California, and he writes us, I bought some audiobooks from Amazon, and when I import them into iTunes, they show up in my music library as opposed to in the audiobook section. Is there a way to move them into my audiobook section? I also have some movies that I'd like to show up in the TV shows library and some iTunes U downloads that I'd like to move into my music library to the podcast section. Trevor, help him out.
There is a simple answer to this one, Matthew. Doug Adams, and by the way, it's not that Douglas Adams, has produced a series of Apple scripts that will do all the things you want and more. They're available from www.dougscripts.com, and I'll send you links to the specific ones you need. All you have to do is download them and follow Doug's very clear instructions. And by the way, they are free, but you're asked to make a donation if you like them.
All right, question two is from Alex Hewitt in London. He wrote, I'm having a problem with iTunes. When I click on a song, I get the message that it can't be found. I've checked that iTunes knows where my library is, which is on an external hard drive. Is there any way I can do this without re-importing 3,000 songs individually? By the way, the songs still work fine on my iPod. Trevor?
Hi, Alex. Well, if iTunes is showing the correct location for your iTunes music folder, I reckon that a couple more steps should get your library up and running again. First, make sure that you've told iTunes to keep your music folder organized. You'll find the instructions for doing this if you go to iTunes Preferences, which is in the iTunes menu, then click on Advanced, then General. Once you've done that, close the preferences, go to the Advanced menu, and choose Consolidate Library, which should reorganize all your music files into your new folder. I've done this with my own iTunes library, Alex, so if you do have any more problems, please get in touch with me again.
And finally, question three is from Billy Jessup in Middlewich in Cheshire, and he writes, I recently purchased one of the new iPod Classics, and when I plug it into my Mac, it optimized it to use with my MacBook Pro. I had no idea that it was changing the disk from an MS-DOS formatted one to an HFS Plus formatted disk. This is now starting to cause me problems when I attempt to transfer files from my Windows PC, as it doesn't recognize the disk format. Is there any way to easily convert it back to the MS-DOS format without having to copy all of my songs over again? And if I do, will it stay in the MS-DOS format?
Yes, Billy, there is a way of doing this, but it will erase all the data from your iPod, including your songs. Essentially, you need to run the restore process on your iPod from within iTunes, then plug the iPod into your PC before you next connect it to your Mac. It's important that you do this because if you connect it to your Mac first, it'll reformat it in HFS Plus format again. You'll find more details of how to do this on page 60 of the iPod Classic Manual, which I'll send you a link to.
Another great job, Trevor. Thanks for taking the time to answer those questions.
No problem at all, Brad. See you next time.
And you can email us with your questions to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. And please remember to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. And that's it for another edition of Mac Format This Week. My thanks to Bob Levitis, Chris Finn, Nicholas Penray, and Trevor Middleton. Our associate producer is Misha Sakalaropoulou. We're back with another edition on Monday, the 26th of November. Until then, I'm Brad Gibson. Thanks for joining us.